Today on Happy, Sick, Confused, Colin Farrell on his cinematic adventures with Oliver Stone, Michael Mann, and now Tim Burton. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Today's episode, first time podcast guest, at least on Happy, Sad, Confused, Mr. Colin Farrell. Someone I've wanted to have on the show for quite a while. So thrilled that Colin made the time on a very brief trip to New York, basically the GMA, me, and I think like one other thing in his 12 hours here. He squeezed us in. I chatted with him for a good 45 minutes in a random anonymous conference room. It didn't matter though. The surroundings were not the important part of it. The important part was his frankness and charm and wit. He is someone who's so talented as an actor, but also someone I always enjoy chatting with because he, you know, he's lived a life. He's certainly, and he's been very open about it. He sprung to fame in his early 20s, thanks to being plucked out of virtual obscurity by Joel Schumacher in the film Tigerland. And then it was off to the races. He was just put into big Hollywood movie after big Hollywood movie, some good, some bad. But he was always someone to watch and always someone that was fascinating to kind of follow. And meanwhile, off screen, he was really, you know, he was dealing with stuff. He was dealing with addictions and the troubles of youth. And it took him a while to get his act together. And thankfully, he's on the other side of it now and can look back at it all with great humor and humility. And that's all you can ask for from somebody, to have a sense of humor about the bizarreness, the bizarre arc of a life. And certainly, Colin was a delight to chat with. His new film is Dumbo. It is the latest from Tim Burton. It is a super sweet movie, I wouldn't say a remake. It's almost like an embellishment. It's a continuation and a new interpretation of the classic Disney story. Features Danny DeVito and Michael Keaton and Ava Green. And I was really charmed by it. It's one of, I think, Tim Burton's best in recent years. And the production design is fantastic. It's very sweet. It recalls a lot of his early work. It reminded me at times of Edward Scissorhands even. And I mean that in the high, that's high compliments as far as I'm concerned. So yes, check out Dumbo this Friday when it's out in theaters. And I hope you guys enjoy this chat as much as I did. Colin he's a special one. So anyway, there's a reason why I wanted him to have him on the show for so long, and I'm happy it finally worked out. A note about the audio. It's not great. Here's the story, guys, just in brief. This has happened maybe once or twice in the history of the 5 years of Happy Sad Confused. The recorder, for whatever reason, didn't record. But thank God, guys, I always have a backup. So there is a backup recording. It just won't sound as great as the usual recordings do. So perfectly listenable. I don't think you'll notice a huge difference, but it's not up to my lofty standards. That being said, it's all about the quality of the conversation, not the audio, as far as I'm concerned. What else to tell you about? I should mention in my MTV shenanigans, there have been some really fun interviews I've done that you can watch on MTV News' YouTube page. Had an extended chat with Jordan Peele, the writer-director of Us, and of course Get Out. That is out there right now. No spoilers in it. Just a fun, smart conversation with one of our really smartest filmmakers working today. Also just chatted with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, star of Veep, yesterday. That's going to be going up on MTV News' YouTube page very soon. That was awesome to do. Someone that I have so much respect for. She's kind of a living icon. And Veep, I have to say, I've seen the first three episodes of the new season. It is so funny. It is maybe my favorite show right now on TV. So look forward to that. And meanwhile, Comedy Central After Hours chugging along. New episode coming out next week with a past podcast guest, someone familiar to Happy, Sad, Confused listeners, a new participant in the After Hours shenanigans, though. So very excited about that. Major TV and soon to be movie star starring in a new After Hours. That's all the tease you get. It's coming very soon, though. That's about it, guys. A lot coming up, a lot of travel for me coming up, some stuff going on with Star Wars, maybe some Marvel stuff. A lot of things are cooking, guys. Anyway, today's event. Mr. Colin Farrell, remember to review, rate, and subscribe to Happy Second Views. Spread the good word and enjoy this chat with Colin.
How you doing, man? How's it going?
All is well. Yeah. All is well. We've just been comparing our... Yeah, but in a good way. I'm going to... Remember I saw you once at the CinemaCon craziness in Vegas? Yeah. That's always like... I go for 4 days, which is...
Is that coming up?
3 days too long for Las Vegas.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Yes, that's on Monday. And then I go to Star Wars Celebration, a Comic-Con devoted to all things Star Wars.
Really? That'll be fun.
It will be fun.
Yeah.
Should
have
we
seen any new stuff?
Nothing. No one sees anything. You know, Disney puts everything under lock and key. Yeah, it's a miracle that we've seen Dumbo.
Did you see it?
I did.
Oh, cool.
Congratulations on it, man.
Thanks, man.
I feel like it's a good litmus test for whether you're alive inside. If you're dead inside, then Dumbo's not for you.
Yeah.
Just icy stare, cold stare.
You've got a kid that's dead inside there. Yeah.
First of all, thanks for the time. As I was saying before, we started this official conversation. This is a quick trip to New York. We are talking before 9 a.m. This is unprecedented for Happy Second Views for my podcast.
It is for you. Me too, man.
Are you a morning guy?
No, not at all. I love night shoots. Everyone else is bitching about night shoots, and I love them.
But luckily, are you on a different time zone right now? Like, we're...
What time zone? I might be somewhere over the Azores. I'm not quite sure what time zone we're on. Because we started the press tour in Los Angeles, then we went to Tokyo, then back to LA for 2 days, then London, Dublin, which isn't much of a jump, of course, and then here, and then home.
Do you resent a little bit that the title guy is not carrying the load for this one? It's like it's on you to...
Dumbo?
Yeah.
Nowhere to be found, surprisingly.
What the fuck?
I know, so selfish. Just takes the glory, has the film named after him, and then disappears.
Is it, in all seriousness, I saw this last night, and I was really moved by it.
It's, oh, cool,
it's so
cool.
Sweet. And we're roughly in the same age range. Where, like, I grew up with Tim Burton. I skipped school when I was 13 years old to see Batman on opening day.
Nice.
I can say that now because I actually have a degree. It all worked out. But did he have resonance for you growing up?
Yeah, I mean, the first film of his I saw was Pee Wee's Big Adventure when my brother showed me, I don't know what age I was, 10 or 11 or 12. And even at that stage, I had that excitement that cinema can offer up sometimes where you're taken out of wherever it is you find yourself in life and you're transported somewhere else, very particular and very otherworldly. Even though Pee Wee's Big Adventure was set in the contemporary world, it was still stylistic to the umpth degree, you know, because of Tim's kind of visual flair, and then everything after that, Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands. He gets such great credit, Burton, for being such an extraordinary visual artist and creating these fantastical worlds. And look, I opened up talking about him by referencing the worlds that he creates. But I don't think people mention, they're affected by it, but I don't think they mention, because it's not as stark, it's not as obvious, the degree of heart that he has as a filmmaker.
Oh, yeah.
There's always some character that's struggling with some deep loneliness, feeling like the outsider, you know, very much a reflection of, I think, Tim's youth in Burbank. You know, he spoke about himself, so I'm not letting any cat out of the bag. But did you ever see the picture of him online in his Halloween costume?
I don't know if I have.
Did you not?
Is it amazing?
Oh, there, it's all you got. I got it done. Mine, you got it? I'll show you this. It's extraordinary. When I saw it first, I feel like he came
out of the womb looking like Tim Burton. Like he, like,
well,
probably...
Well, you know what? It might have taken him 8 or 9 years to look like the Burton that we know. But to arrive at this so early in life, which is... You can tell me what it is now. You'll know as soon as you see it. Okay, what's that?
That's Nightmare Before Christmas. That's Jack Skellington.
Yeah.
That's his Halloween costume as a child?
When he's 8 or 9 or 10.
Amazing.
I don't know what age he is. And he created a prototype for Jack Skellington. Isn't that just so much? So since then, he's been kind of, I suppose, I shouldn't speak for him, but I'm going to anyway. He's been wrestling with, you know, what it is to be included or excluded or belong, or that sense of not belonging that we all struggle with sometimes as human beings. And that's all over his work. And Dumbo's the quintessential outsider, somebody who's judged so harshly because of some physical anomaly they're born with that is deemed too different to be allowed into the social stratus, you know.
It did remind me, to a surprising degree, in the best possible way, of Edward Scissorhands. I was watching it, I was kind of just like having flashbacks to how I felt watching that one.
That's cool.
And you mentioned the emotion. I always think back to Edward. Boy, I was so moved by the end of that film.
By Edward Scissorhands?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was so moving. Yeah, my kids love that now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's, you know, he's just, he's cross-generational, really. I think his work will never go out of fashion as long as there's loneliness in the human condition.
Sadly, like that means it will. Yeah, exactly. What's the quintessential I'm on a Tim Burton set moment for this one?
Like, I mean, Jesus. The first day I arrived on the set, we were doing the first scene that I appear in the film, which is Holt getting off the train, arriving back, having fought in the first war. So I walked into his studio stage, and there's, you know, a full steam train with steam bellowing from its chimney, and people in period costume jumping on and off the train with green screen. So that was even just that.
I've joined the circus officially.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. As Orson Welles said, I get to play with the biggest train set in the world now.
Yeah.
And I loved watching Tim on set. I just loved, he's so playful and frenetic. He's like a Tasmanian dust devil. You know, you really would get a creak in your neck trying to keep up with him. He's left, right, back, forth. He's all over the place, but detailed and just really engaged in the whole process. Every day going to work on this was like going to a circus, albeit a static one, not a traveling one, but because we shot in the one location. There wasn't a single frame that was shot outside. It was all inside, which was kind of magic to see the film then and see how, you know, 40 or 50% of it is told under, you know, an afternoon sky or a sunset.
Those beautiful skies, oh my God.
Beautiful sunsets. And obviously that was all down to the wizardry of those who work after the fact, after the shoot, you know. And what they did with Dumbo, the actual creature, how they brought that to life, which, imagine the pressure. Imagine that pressure.
If that doesn't work.
Seriously, yeah. We had a whole film there. The only thing that was missing was the central character, right, the flying baby elephant. So I just thought what they did was extraordinary with that.
It's funny. Like, I don't know about you, but for me, the people that really get me excited and kind of like pinch me moments on my side of the job is like talking to people like Tim, people that I grew up with.
Like the
fact that like Tim Burton knows my name at this point is like the greatest brag I'm happy to like throw around, because it just breaks my brain in two. For you, is it similar to kind of like work with those folks that really made an impression?
I mean, I remember
10
the first
and 15
time,
or whatever.
The only time I worked with Al Pacino, I was 20, maybe 24. Maybe, I don't think it was 20. Yeah, 23 or 24. And I arrived on a set and, you know, Pacino was getting mic'd up and we did our first scene together. And it really was a pinch me moment, because I had grown up with all his films, you know, Serpico and Dog Day and on and Godfathers and on and on. But I still get it. I don't feel jaded by it. It's not that I work not to be jaded or stay fresh or stay grateful. That all that stuff may be there in shades, but it's just, I just have some, there's a kid inside me that will not be quietened completely, and nor should he be.
Yeah.
And he's still very alive. And when I go onto a set like this one and I see the extraordinary elaborate worlds that are created, because as I said, there was so much CGI with the flying elephant and skylines and such, but all the stuff that was around us, all the tents, all the grass, all the trapeze artists, the contortionists from Mongolia, that was all there. I mean, you'd walk, it'd be 10 o'clock in the morning and you'd leave the outside where all the trailers were parked, where all the actors and stunts would live, and you'd go into this big warehouse, and it was just extraordinary what you'd see.
Yeah.
You know, it was extraordinary. So, and again, working with Tim was a bit of a pinch me moment for me as well.
Surprised there was a little bit more nudity from Danny DeVito than you in this one.
More
flesh from Danny.
Well, if you watch, you know, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
That's
true.
Danny
does like to drop trow every now and then.
I don't know if he likes it, but
I think he does. I think he does. He's been a repeat offender.
Crawling out of couches, leather couches.
Yeah. Fully Vaseline.
Exactly. Always. That's his style.
Danny brought his own amniotic fluid. Why? Well, I'll just roll the camera and we'll show you.
Exactly. Okay, since we've got some time, let's go down memory lane. It's early. Maybe I'll get some tears flowing before 9 a.m.
This is
catharsis.
Let's do it.
Okay, so
people feeling on
that. That's right.
New Jersey Turnpike.
Exactly. So growing up in Dublin, family of more athletes than
my
thespians.
My father and his brother played professional football, otherwise known as soccer. They played for years, my dad earned his living until he was about 25 or 26. I think he had shoddy knees that didn't quite go the distance, but that was it. And I thought that was my life until I was about 14, was playing football, playing soccer sun up till sundown every day. I thought that's what I was possibly going to do with my life, but it wasn't good enough.
Now, was when you started to exhibit interest in this profession, in the arts, what was the reaction from the family? Was there an adjustment period in terms of...
There was no real... My dad wasn't too impressed, as is often the story when it comes to exploring a livelihood in the arts. My dad wasn't impressed. Very, very working class, stock. He was a hard worker all his life, and he had a business. that I'm sure he kind of fancied I would go into. So he wasn't too impressed, but then the first paycheck came in and he was all right with it.
What was acting, in a way, you think, like your first form of rebelling, or was rebelling maybe your
really.
first form of rebelling
was just rebelling. It was drinking and smoking and all the other stuff that you get to, you know, force the hand of your education with. But it was the first thing that maybe perhaps that I felt was entirely mine. You know, when you're in a family, of course, you're sharing things. You're sharing a home. You're sharing meals. You're sharing philosophies. You're sharing burdens, laughs, traumas, all the above. And this was the first thing that I felt was completely my doing or my creation or my realm that I could inhabit. And it was my thing and nobody else was really part of it. Which is, I'm glad to say, has changed through the years. And now, of course, family, we travel together sometimes, they come and visit, or if we're on the road doing promotional tours like this, I might have some family with me, etc. But at that time, yeah, it was also, I think it was an opportunity to, like many young boys, I grew up in a house where emotions and feeling and the expressing of feelings and emotions wasn't really,
right,
you know, the done thing, or wasn't really something to be favored. So when I went and did some acting classes and some workshops when I was 16 or 17 in Dublin, it allowed me to have a kind of an emotional language that I hadn't had the opportunity in school, trying to be a guy and toughen up.
Wait, you guys want to hear about my feelings? You want me to access that stuff?
Yeah,
what?
I mean, Dad used to literally say, you know, emotions are weakness, and it's no small irony that I make my living expressing and exploring my own emotions and whatever intellect I have. So it was the first time, I remember feeling, wow, this is incredibly liberating. It was incredibly liberating.
Do you remember a shift in terms of taste in film and actors? You talked about Pacino, but growing up, like, and I've had this kind of conversation with a lot of people where, you know, at first it's you know, I grew up with like Spielberg and you know, all the Star Wars and all that kind of stuff. And then at a certain point you pop in the double cassette of The Godfather and you're like,
the sea change film for me was Paris, Texas.
Oh, okay.
That was
Wim Wenders, right?
Yeah, that was my wake up call. It was just the first time that I had been removed from the world of entertainment, of the Spielbergian Amblin world of, you know, Close Encounters and E.T. and Indiana Jones or Back to the Futures, you know, all those classic films that I now share with my kids. It was the first time I got exposed to a heavier fare that was dealing with the existential crises of being a human being and living with a broken heart and loneliness and isolation and fracture and all those things. So that was Paris, Texas. When I saw that film, I was so moved, and I felt that there was, even though I was only 16, 17, I felt like it spoke to me loudly and clearly as to certain questions and difficulties and struggles that I felt inside.
And what was the, as a 16, 17 year old, did you already have kind of Hollywood and the United States in your sights in terms of an ultimate goal?
I didn't even, how did it happen? So I did an acting workshop when I was, I think, 16, and I loved it. And that lasted, maybe there was a 10-week course or something like that. And then I was still in high school at that stage, and then I got thrown out of high school and didn't know what I was going to do in my life. I did bits and pieces, worked as a painter, I worked as a country and western line dancing instructor.
Sure, as one does.
Yeah, in Ireland in the, you know, early 90s.
Were you good at that? Was that a...
I was all right, it was handy enough. It's not, you know, it's not Kirov Ballet. You know? So I was handy enough. We had a coach, flew in from Texas to put us through our paces, and then he had a bunch of Irish traveling in a minivan around the country, going to little pubs and, you know, wearing headsets and thinking we were... the Madonna's version of Western Stars.
Is the skill listed on the CV still, just in case? Like
somewhere there, yeah. Way, way, way below horse riding and swimming, which I can't do, but it's even below that. I went to Australia when I was 17 to live for a year, and that was the first time that I fell in with a group of artists who were quite extraordinary and used to, you know, drink vodka and really thick black coffee and smoke bongs and talk about Tarkovsky and Dostoevsky and all these skis that I had no idea who they were, and they were kind of very prominent part of whatever learning curve I've experienced as an actor, a man, and that was the first time I got to work on a piece of text with those guys. I did a play in Australia about the Kelly Ring, Kelly, Ned Kelly and the Bushrangers.
Uh-huh.
And I played Steve Hart, and that was the first time, as I said. So it was the first time, you know, I'd done workshops before that, but I was with a bunch of actors. I was paid a couple of $100 a week, and we were working on a text and rehearsing, and we put the show up, and it was brown trousers time. I was so nervous, but it was extraordinary just being with these people and exchanging thoughts and ideas and feelings and applying ourselves to this text. And so when I got home to Dublin after my year in Australia, I was 18, I went to theatre school full time. I decided to give it a go, but I wasn't thinking Hollywood, I wasn't thinking America. I was just too nervous and too kind of comprehensively dealing with the day-to-day business of working on monologues and and texts.
Were you going up for the kinds of parts that you would end up getting, like before Tiger Land comes around? Tiger Land, of course, is the Joel Schumacher film, which
first American film, which was crazy after that. No, I had done a TV show in Ireland called Ballycus Angel, which afforded me the opportunity not to go back. I'm good at not finishing things, apparently, except for films, because it'd be hard to.
That wouldn't work, yeah. Where's Colin?
Yeah, he's decided to leave after second act. He'll be okay without me. I did 2 years on that, and the reason I left theatre school, I didn't go back for the second year, and it was a full-time course. I had a great first year. I did an audition that summer, and I got offered this role in Ballycus Angel, and I thought, okay, so I'm here to learn how to approach character, to, you know, take a script apart and find relevance for me as an actor in these roles, but basically ultimately to get work as an actor, to learn how to work as an actor. And so I got offered this opportunity to do that, and I thought, well, I won't go back for the second year. So I did 2 years on this TV show, which was amazing training. Got to work with incredible Irish actors like Tony Doyle and Bertie Sweeney, and then I did a play in London, and then a small part in a film in Dublin based on the play. There was an actor in London who came to see me, an American actor who came to see me in the play, and he was doing a film in Dublin, and he spoke to the director. I met the director and I got cast in that film. It wasn't a very good film at all, but it was enough to get me an American agent.
Right.
And then based on that, I ended up sending a tape to Joel Schumacher, who directed Tigerland. And I remember Joel saying, look, you know, something along the lines of, we don't love you enough to fly you over to Los Angeles, but if you happen to be in town, it'll be good for you to read in person. So, of course, I jumped on the first plane and flew over. And so, yeah, anytime I like to say I wasn't that ambitious as a kid is obviously bullshit, because I got on the plane.
Yeah.
I got on the plane, I headed west. And I've always just basically pursued the opportunities that were presented to me, you know, which is why at this stage I think I'd like to get more involved. I want to direct at some stage, you know, comes a time where just iterating, albeit as much as you try to own them, the words of others kind of almost isn't enough, you know.
Yeah.
You see how all-encompassing directing is, and writing is beautiful as well, is incredibly therapeutic. And but anyway, yeah, that was Tigerland. Was a huge
an amazing film in a number of respects. I mean, it makes your career, despite actually not being seen by it, didn't
thing. No, the industry saw it.
The industry, the right people saw
and
it.
And I heard that when Joel was cutting it together in Tigerland, look. Like,
it was a glorified audition video for you. Who was your calling card?
Really expensive. Yeah, $10 million.
Didn't make the studio any money, but it made your career.
Yeah, showreel. $10 million showreel. But Joel was very open in the editing room when he was cutting that together, and there was directors I heard of that were going in to have a look because they had heard about this Irish kid who was in it, who was supposedly decent. And it's a business, like most major, you know, at the top end of most businesses, there is an element of fear. Fear compels people, and fear breeds competition and all that kind of thing. Well, it's no different, and maybe more so in Hollywood. So I think I capitalized on the fear of a lot of people that were like, well, we don't want to miss him, so someone throw a lot of money at him. And I earned so much money in the first 5 years. You know, I really did. It was insane. I mean, I went from $30,000 in my first film to $2.5 million in my third, and I was 23. I mean, it was just madness.
You in particular, I feel like, when I look back at what happened there, and I think of someone like McConaughey, that Schumacher similarly kind of helped with A Time to Kill, like, you stand for, like, that time when you could make someone's career and really give them some huge, exciting opportunities and go from 0 to 60. Yeah. Suddenly you're starring with Pacino and Bruce Willis and
Tom Cruise.
And it's in Minority Report, of course. And, like, so for, at that point, are you just riding the wave? Or do you feel like you're in control of your own destiny?
No, not in control. I mean, I think I like to present the appearance that I was in some version of control, in the way, of course, that I could do that, because there's no way to control a machine that's as big as the machine that was behind me, and I include any element of interest expressed by a studio. Like, there was a lot of energy that I capitalized on in my career initially, of course, but I think the way I tried to present the idea of control was to pretend that I didn't care about any of it.
Yeah,
too not cool that I knew school, I was yeah. pretending. I was just like, it all means nothing and this and that and the other. And it was just a lot. Look, it was great and it was massive good fortune, but it was a lot. And I was still very young in my journey as an actor as well. As I said, I had only done a workshop when I was 16. I had just done one play
right.
as much as I was turned on by it with a bunch of actors in Australia when I was 18. And then I came back and I did 1 year in theatre school, 2 years on a television show, one play, small part in a terrible film. And then all of a sudden I did this one thing in America and it was off to the races. So it was a lot. I still was figuring out what my relationship was to yeah. acting and how much I liked it. And all of a sudden my passion for it, I suppose, was cut into by how I responded or how I was dealing with the amount of enormous fame that came seemingly overnight.
So I'm curious, like, is there imposter syndrome then where, like, yeah, you're totally. Like, I'm getting these yeah, opportunities yeah, yeah. and in your heart imposter of hearts, syndrome. You're like, I'm not ready for yeah, that. I shouldn't be getting this.
Totally, totally, totally. And, you know, there might be still shavings of that that still exist.
Anyone worth their salt, you know, I totally, hopefully yeah, doesn't think they actually deserve to be there.
No, of course, because we don't. There's so much chance, you know? There's so much chance. There is no answer to why me and not that person, because it's not just, look, there's actors that are on a stage in small towns in Bulgaria now that are more than able, if not better, at doing what I do than I am. And so, you know, there's no rhyme or reason. There's just so much chance, and you use whatever opportunity comes your way and you work as hard as you can. But there was, yeah, imposter syndrome, or a little bit of guilt as well, you know, mm-hmm. that all this stuff was coming and I didn't understand it. And it was just so, it was so much so quick.
I mean, you've obviously been always remarkably candid and like I feel like you spent especially like the last like 6 or 7 years apologizing for your first 10 years in your career. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
because yeah, look, I mean, you were also, you talk about kind of growing in as an actor, you were kind of figuring out who you are as a human being. Yeah. You were
very much,
yeah. you know, there was a bit of arrested development, yeah. safe to say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, were you able to compartmentalize, like you were, you know, dealing with stuff offset and kind of addictions and that kind of thing. Were you able to actually be the professional you needed to be on set?
I mean, I was, yeah, I really was, and that didn't do me any favors. You know, it did many productions a favor because it meant that the way I was living offset didn't bleed onto. I mean, I don't know what the performances would have been like if I was sober. I don't know if they'd be better or worse. Right. I would never know, and I don't really care. It's kind of irrelevant. But I had an engine, you know, and I was young. I was 23, 24, 25, 26, 27 before I got sober, and I had an engine. I could go out till 5 o'clock in the morning. Get an hour and a half sleep and then put in a 14-hour day where I wouldn't miss a beat, wouldn't miss a mark, wouldn't drop a line, wouldn't. I was very professional, which I know is ridiculous to say, but,
right.
you know, I certainly had the appearance of that. So I got away with murder for years.
Did you know, did you intellectualize, like, at some point this is going to run out? Like, I'm not immortal, or were
no.
you, or every 25-year-old does think you're immortal?
No,
immortal.
Like any decent addict, you don't think, you know, in rational terms like that. Not yeah. at all. No, but you're just, you know, you're I suppose in any kind of struggle with addiction and in any livelihood that one is involved in while they deal with addiction, I suppose you're constantly trying to prop yourself up. You're constantly behind yourself. You're living in a state of not trying to make mistakes.
Right.
Which is kind of a negative.
Mitigate failure and
of course, yeah. all that stuff. So that's not, you know, that does not scream of the opportunity to have expansive freedom within your artistic endeavor. Do you know what I mean?
Do you remember times where, like, did any actors or filmmakers, like, pull you aside and kind of read you
no.
the riot act? And
no, not at all. Really? No, because as I said,
you
on
were doing
set,
your thing. You were...
I was doing my thing, and I was, you know, I was doing a decent enough job.
Never nearly fired from a gig. You were always
no. There was a couple of hairy. Don't get me wrong. There was a couple of hairy days. There was one line in Minority Report. I asked them, you know, with a great degree of arrogance, would they not work me the day after my birthday? Please don't have me working on June 1st because my birthday is May 31st, and you know I thought a $100 million film would at least listen to that request.
I mean,
possibly,
Stephen,
possibly you know conceive of honouring it, but Stephen, but they did. I worked, I think it was June 1st, and yeah, it was a rough night. I didn't get any sleep, and that was one time where the line was, "I'm sure you've all grasped the fundamental paradox of pre-crime methodology," and I only know it now, still, you know, 16 years later, because it should be on my tombstone, because it caused so much panic and anxiety. My sister was on the set that day, and she had to leave the set. I think I did 36 takes, and it was a disaster. But so, look, there was days where it was a little bit hairy, but, you know, by and large, no.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so it's funny, Minority Report always sticks out at me. That's such a great I love your performance in that. I loved it. It just came at such a perfect time in terms of you kind of. It's a fun role because you kind of get to give Cruise some shit.
Tom,
and like,
Tom had any fear of my rising star or any of that nonsense. I'm truly not saying that, but there was a kind of a mirroring of, you know, sure, this cocky little upstart in life, and he was more established in his career, and that's exactly what was happening in the film. You know, this guy Danny Whitworth was trying to supplant himself into Tom Cruise's career, Anderton's career. So it was clever casting.
Jumping around, we talked a little bit about The Recruit, which is obviously a great opportunity to work with Pacino. That's a pinch me moment. Your one contribution to the superhero genre, Daredevil.
Yeah.
You got in a little too early, I feel like, in that one.
Too early, yeah. It wasn't the Marvel that we've all grown to love and
that being said, I
reaped massive reward from being a part of.
You never got bad notices for that. You actually got good notices for Daredevil, as I recall.
Yeah.
Should I be surprised that you haven't kind of re-entered the DC Marvel universe? Have they talked to you about that stuff?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't be surprised if I was you. I wouldn't know what it is to be. But I'm not surprised myself. I don't want for much, Josh. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And you know, the work has been good to me and for me for years, and I truly feel more connected to it now than I ever have. It's this strange paradox that somehow when you don't identify your worth with something as much as maybe you once did, then you're free to enjoy it to a greater degree.
Well, and part of it is as I'm on the outside looking in, and I sort of look at the whole body of work, especially in recent years, is like there must be something freeing about not chasing a certain kind of ideal where, like,
yeah,
you know, you've been the leading man and you can be the leading man, but it seems like you're just as content to be
totally
the supporting guy, and you've relished those opportunities.
Yeah, totally. I mean, if there wasn't, you know, certain responsibilities and stuff, I'd be okay doing one or two $5 million budget films. I mean, they're the ones that speak to me loudest and clearest, of course, are the ones that are more intimate, whether it's The Imbruges or The Lobsters or Ondine, which nobody saw, which I'm glad I did because I got my youngest son out of. But yeah, no, I'm glad that chapter, that first 7-year chapter is done, because it was, as I said, not that I'm in control. There are too many factors that are related to my quote-unquote career now that I don't feel in control of it totally. But back then, the ship was bigger, it was faster, it took a longer time to write it, to turn direction, the momentum was huge. So I'm glad that it's different these days.
Part of me wants to just start a podcast series with you discussing two films in particular, Alexander and Miami Vice. I feel like there could be like a 10-hour miniseries on each of those.
Yeah, they were both very, very elaborate, very dramatic, slash traumatic slash fantastic exciting adventures, and they both films took 6 months to shoot. Both films had 2 or 3 months, 4 months of pretty intense prep. Both films weren't received in the way that people that were involved in them hoped they'd be received, but they both they were great parts of my learning curve again.
So I've again, since we're in the same age group, I assume Oliver meant a lot to you growing up. I remember seeing JFK blew my brains.
JFK blew me away, it's still a really pleasing watch. I don't care how factually, you know, obvious it may be.
As just as like a dramatic thriller. It's
a pleasing watch.
John Candy.
He shoots John Candy with those close-ups with a cigarette, and it's just so tasty.
That, like, 20-minute monologue Jones. By Donald Sutherland in the middle of the film.
Yeah,
it's
it's great. And Costner's a fantastic actor.
Absolutely.
He's a fantastic actor.
I
watched Field of Dreams recently. When was the last time you watched that?
I watched it many times, because that one wrecks me.
It's really beautiful. Oh, my God.
Kind of a perfect movie.
Burt Lancaster,
So Oliver...
And Platoon was a big one for me, you know, which was why when Tigerland came around, and Tigerland obviously never makes it across the ocean to Vietnam. It was set around the time the troops were beginning to be withdrawn, and the tide was changing here. There was no support in America, rightfully enough. But I wasn't obsessed by that period in American history, but that war was kind of, you know, it was kind of a cinematic war that you grow up with.
Yeah.
And that was the war that I grew up with, was the Vietnam War. So, yeah, Oliver was huge to
me. I mean, I feel like Alexander is one of those examples of what happens when you give, and I mean this in the best possible way, like a madman. He's kind of a crazy man, crazy genius. $100 million to make the passion project that he's had since he was a teenager.
And they're all mad, by the way. I mean, Peter Weir is mad in the most dignified and classical way. He's like a very mild-tempered professor, but he's just his attention to detail is insane. Terrence Malick, Tim Burton, you know, Oliver... Oliver has a kind of passion to him and a kind of an animalism to him.
He's a provocateur. Yeah, he's absolutely. Like, in both the product
work that he's doing now, you know, the documentary work yep. that he's doing now, and the people that he's interviewing around the world, and as much as he may be limited in how hard he can hit people like Putin, you know, I have to take my hat off to him. He's asking questions and he's putting the camera in places absolutely. That the Western world wouldn't be exposed to if it weren't for him. So to work with him on this was extraordinary. But, you know, he had a bunch of actors as well that were, we were all in our own little way.
Interesting journeys at the time. Yeah. Val Kilmer's a little left of center,
Val,
what?
You know, Angelina, Jared Rosario, and then cast a bunch of actors to play the generals from Dublin, from various parts of Ireland, from Kerry and Cork, and it was a shit show. It was wonderful, and it was a very old-fashioned way of making
right.
huge epic films. You know, David Lean said that film production is the last great circus, and it was very much, you know, we started in North Africa, we were there for 3 or 4 months, and then we moved to Pinewood in London, and then we went to Thailand and we finished up 2 months in Thailand, and it was incredible. But the film wasn't what we'd hoped it would be, but the experience was just enormous.
I would imagine. My one of my offsided anecdotes I bring up on the podcast all the time is one of my favorite flights I've ever been on is when I happened to sit next to Oliver on a flight to LA, and we ended up watching the Gary Marshall film New Year's Eve together.
Fantastic. Oh, that's brilliant. The one that got away for Oliver, of course.
He had so many questions about it. Who's that?
Really,
who's that?
I bet you that was really confusing for him. More than
I swear to God. He was writing down notes like,
more than
who is Leah Michelle?
More than any didactic that would be. Did he take his notepad out of his pocket?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot to say.
He's in the world of post-its. He thinks so much, and he's such a fluid thinker, and speaking to Oliver. Astonishingly impressive man.
My sense from hearing you talk about Miami Vice is it's probably not a pleasant watch for you to see that film now.
I've said this before, kind of, you know, joking, but, you know, half in jest, full in earnest, but I honestly could only remember about a third of it. That was when we were shooting Miami Vice was when I was kind of getting close to being done with just personally living a particular way that I was, and I was pretty sick, just garden variety, you know, alcoholic and drug addict at the time, and certainly my pursuit of oblivion had, you know, taken the lead over my pursuit of any artistic integrity or any desire to tell stories that were of worth. Which is not to say I ever stopped caring about the work. That's really not true. But I just didn't know how to really care about anything in an engaging, uncluttered way.
Well, it must have been a particular challenge. I mean, you're dealing with all that stuff, and then you're dealing with like the most meticulous. Human being on the planet, Michael Mann, who does not suffer fools.
No, he doesn't. And look, I got on decently with Michael, and we had our run-ins and stuff. And when I see him socially now, he's the loveliest man of all the time in the world. From when I've crossed paths with him through the years, but at the time there was a degree of detail, and there was a degree that did feel at times constricting. Sure. You know, there was a little. It's a film that, from talking to, you know, fans of film, cinephiles, or just Joe blogs, it has garnered in the last few years a favor that it didn't have when it came out.
Yeah.
People have come back and found it and thought that it wasn't as bad as maybe they initially reacted to it. But there was a certain life that I shared with Jamie, which is a very grandiose way of saying we got on well,
mm-hmm.
and we had a laugh off camera. And while I never thought it should have been a buddy movie, and I thought it should have, and it did try to honor in a contemporary way the tone of the original series, I thought there could have been a little bit more light between the two of us.
Yeah.
And that was one of my, creatively, that was just one of my great frustrations, was that Jamie and I, again, not that it should have been high fives, and it was never going to be Lethal Weapon, it wasn't designed to be Lethal Weapon, which is brilliant. But we could have got a little bit more of what we were doing off camera into the characters and a little bit more of the history that way. But I also understood what Michael was going for, which was the unspoken sense of trust.
Yes.
And the deep familiarity that transcends language or affection demonstrated between two men, you know, who really had each other's backs. But it was a tough gig. It was a tough gig. Yeah.
Did you find clarity in your personal life informed your work immediately, sort of when you kind of like got a little bit more on the straight and narrow?
The most practical difference that I noticed was how limiting the way I had worked was. I would desperately try to understand what a particular scene was about and what the purpose of the scene was and what my job was within a scene, which is fair enough, and I would pursue that one thought rather than what I noticed when I got a little bit on the straight and narrow and I was less cluttered, less fearful. I don't know if I was less fearful, but I was certainly less cluttered. I was, you know, less tired. I was just more open and more available.
Right.
What I found was that I could arrive at what my sense of understanding was in regard to the life of a character, and I could take that, and then I could do the scene three or four, not diametrically opposed ways, but three or four different ways. I could modulate, I could have a freedom and play within a scene, and what you're doing in that case, of course, though, is you're obviously trusting the director, because they get to really, really shape your performance.
Right, modulate you, and give me 10% more
honestly,
here.
Honestly, they really have as much, if not more, of an influence of how your character is ultimately represented in a film than you do. But I found that freedom, and I found that very liberating, and I found that very satisfying as well, that I didn't just pursue one idea, take after take, try and get that one thing, which is both ineffable and unattainable. I would play within the scene knowing that there was no right or no wrong. There were just different varieties and different modulations that I was given a director.
It is interesting to see like the range of filmmakers that you've worked with and seemingly enjoyed working with in your career. Love Malick, but he couldn't be more different, I would think, than Martin McDonagh.
Yeah. And Martin and Terry have a good friendship as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Martin was a huge fan of, I think, Badlands is a really important film for him, as it is for so many of us. I've never been able to answer with any degree of honesty or certainty the question, how do you like to work? Do you like to rehearse or not rehearse? That question right there, do you like to rehearse or not rehearse? I swear to God, man, you can put me in a room, you know, and give me room service every day for a week, I still wouldn't be able to come up with an answer. I like to go off the director. I really do. And it's not because I there's been times where I've questioned, should I have a particular way to work after doing this for 20 years? Shouldn't I be more certain or exercise any kind of degree of strength that might be permitted because of the body of work that I've done? And it's like, no, I love going to work and seeing what kind of environment and what dynamic directors like to create, and then not losing myself in that, but totally applying whatever it is I do or whatever it is I feel to the structure that is presented by them. So Martin McDonagh, you rehearse in a black box room for 3 weeks before you go onto the set. Yorgos Lanthimos, you know, not at all. We played a couple of little kind of theatre school games, you know, back to back, and with Nicole, and you face that corner, now shout your lines at each other. We did that for about 3 hours on a Thursday, and that was rehearsal.
When Nicole's like, I've done this with Lars von Trier, I got this. Yeah. I think I know how to do this.
No, she's fairly, Nicole's fairly unflappable.
I love that performance. I love Killing of a Sacred Deer, but I also love, I mean, The Lobster, it must be so pleasing for you to watch. I mean, this sounds a little loaded, but like to watch yourself in that film, it's like you're playing. You look more like me than you look like you in that film.
You should say that, Josh. There was a picture of you in my trailer.
the truth revealed.
You heard it here first. No, I look. It was. I mean, that whole film, I was sure I was never going to work again. I really was. I remember saying to my sister, "I am. This is it. I am going to be. This is the dullest, most boring. Because you know, as actors, we often."
I want to act, I want to do stuff.
Yeah, as human beings, we think if we're not doing something, if we're not being active, if we're not moving, if we're not expressing our thoughts, if we're not moving, then we're not doing something. If we're not expressing our thoughts, then we don't have opinions. And so it's very much the same as an actor. You are given carte blanche. It's called drama for a reason, and you feel the burden of that. You feel if you're not doing something, if you're not emoting. But sure, the audience are already thinking, feeling, sentient human beings, and sometimes they just want to reflect, project their emotions upon what they're seeing on the screen. So The Lobster was the perfect example of that. I did so little. But it was fairly specific, it was fairly uniform, I have to say, but there was no, I was sure I wasn't going to work after that film. Seeing the films, Josh, never. There's twice in my life I can remember seeing films that I was in that my presence didn't totally ruin the experience. And that was The New World, because it was so aesthetically just jaw-droppingly beautiful, and Dumbo, because of the similar reason, you know, albeit one is artifice and one is the rawness of nature, Dumbo being the artifice, Dumbo being, you know,
right.
As I say, the sets were real, but there was so much kind of that went in after the fact, and it was so elaborate and so colourful and so manufactured by the human imagination and the human touch in relation to the craftsman that created the sets. New World was the other thing, was just catching nature on the fly. It was Terry with a camera on his shoulder most of the time. Oh God, was that an osprey? And off he'd go into the distance while you were halfway through a line, and it wasn't insulting because it was so pure. So those are the two films, because they're so kind of total in the beauty of their aesthetic, that I could kind of nearly almost perhaps. Small bit.
Any more qualifiers?
Enjoy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed you in Fantastic Beasts.
Oh, thanks.
I thought it was an exceptional performance. I loved you and Ezra in that film. I have a great fondness for Ezra, who is a wild man in the best possible way. I'm just curious, like, what was it like to work with Ezra and be around Ezra's like crazy life force? Did he remind you a little bit of your own?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, Ezra was a lot more refined. His life force was a lot more refined. Than it felt less scatological than mine was back in the day. Perhaps.
Less whoopee cushions? What are we saying?
No, he just, you know, it was just less of a shit show, I suppose.
That's a nice way of saying it.
Literal translation for radio.
He's actually keeping it together.
Yeah, no, he was... He's an extraordinary man. He's incredibly bright and talented, and his spirit is just so fluid and buoyant and rich, I feel. I loved working with him. I loved that relationship, exploring that relationship. There was no, you know, I heard after the fact that some people were alluding to some homoerotic underpinnings between he and I. That was never referred to. That is a pure example of what the audience brings to the table. But there certainly was an emotional manipulation going on, and the sensual collateral of touch,
right,
and the whispered word was used heavily by Graves, and he could see that this child was fractured, and he just, you know, stepped into the chasm and did what he needed to do to meet his ends. But I loved it. It was great fun. It was great fun to be part of that canon, you know, because again, no matter how long I'm acting, I can never act longer than I've been a fan of film. So that's first and foremost. I love films. I go to the cinema all the time. I adore them. They're not ruined for me. Quite the opposite with my involvement in making them. And it was great to be part of that canon. It was a lovely world to step on to. Again, it was, you know, these worlds of imagination that were represented by what J.K. Rowling created, you know, in Harry Potter and Fantastic Beasts, and what Tim Burton has created for 30 plus years, and what he created with Dumbo, are incredible worlds to step into.
Yeah.
They're more exciting in a childlike way than the lobsters and the sacred deers, of course.
It touches
sacred
a different part of you. Yeah.
Really,
yeah,
touch an existential part of me that still struggles with the meaning of life. Dumbo and Fantastic Beasts, not so much, but God, it's a good day out at the office, you know.
I remember talking to you once, we were talking when we sat down here about, I'm going to CinemaCon next week in Vegas. I was interviewing you on a carpet there. It was for the Sofia Coppola film, and Oldman walked by.
Oh, yeah.
You guys
had a
great moment.
Oh, that was beautiful.
What a spirit.
Lovely. And there was me caught in a moment's...
No, truly.
...honesty.
I saw a 12-year-old Colin.
Totally. And he is there. He's in the passenger seat. He was more in the driver's seat some years ago.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But he's in the passenger seat, and he'll never be evicted from the car, and he's earned his place, you know? But that was, having a little word with Oldman that day. I mean, huge. I grew up, you know, Sid and Nancy and Mean Time and, you know, every other film that he's you know... He's just an extraordinary
Let's not forget about the transformation that is Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I was
obsessed.
Which I loved when that came out.
I literally memorized that script, I think, at the time.
God, that's another really pleasing watch still to this day. It's a really pleasing watch.
Well, because of the way Coppola approached it, too. He used old-school effects.
Absolutely.
It's not dated
gothic,
at all.
Practical.
It's just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that bat suit at the end was extraordinary.
Exactly.
CGI, you know, I mean, there's not a lot you can do with a flying elephant. You got to go CGI. But
sure.
Tim is adamant that as much reality as can be lent to the experience of telling his stories, he'll get in there and lend it.
No, I'm thrilled. I was frankly relieved how much in watching it. He's gone to different ends of the spectrum. He's used CGI a lot.
Totally.
The Alice films
Wonderland,
he had to.
Yeah, absolutely.
But this works.
With a mix of special effects and practical, this is, again, akin to, as you were saying, Edward Scissorhands a little bit.
Yeah. Speaking of stuff like Fantastic Beasts, are the kids more of a deciding factor at all in terms of Dumbo?
No, it's just good fortune. Yeah, it's just a nice kickback to do something that they can actually see, you know, because they're not really in Bruges and Sacred Deer aren't appropriate yet.
You're not going to start them with Sacred Deer? That's not the...
Oh, my God. No, it's always, yeah.
Let's see what happens to a child if I begin them with Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Yeah. And get a pillowcase to put over their heads and see how they react while they're watching it. No. Yeah, it's nice to do things that they're... It was really nice to sell this film, Dumbo on the Road, because just the sense of light around the whole thing was really extraordinary and infectious. And we did the premiere in LA, and it was just kids and families. And
yeah.
I thought, man, Dwayne Johnson is... onto something. This is a beautiful energy to be a part of putting out into the world, you know, instead of usually having depressed adults leave my films.
Right.
It's these kind of, you know, feelings, yeah.
And earnestness is like the one thing that like feels like is out of fashion now, so any antidote to that is like so welcome.
There's nothing if it's not earnest at its center, you know.
Yeah, you gotta just embrace it. Yeah. So what is the, do you trust your gut more in terms of how you choose your stuff nowadays? Like, do you feel like you have a better sense of how to navigate the career?
No, and any films that I did from, you know, 2000 to 2008 or 10 or whatever, they were all still on paper. They were, it's always a shot in the dark. It's always a shot. There are just too many factors involved in making a film. Look, I see a film that I think might be a steaming turd, and I still take my hat off to the endeavor.
And
the effort that goes into it. And nobody goes out to make a bad film. But I don't feel like I have any better creative barometer or any higher degree of certainty as to what will or won't work. It's just a case of wherever you find yourself on a particular day and the questions you have in life, and you know, you have a marriage of your own beliefs and the beliefs that are represented in the material, or there's a diametrical push between what you believe as a human being and your philosophies of life and the material. But you just have to be curious. There has to be something in it that moves you. You know, when I read The Lobster, I did not know what the hell they just did to my brain after an hour and a half of reading. And I couldn't envision a world where you could deliver these lines in a way that were normal.
Right.
That weren't weird.
Right.
That the character wasn't feeling like it. I was like, how do you inhabit that to the point where you can just have these conversations and they can be just a normal way of communicating? But I'd seen Dogtooth. And that's what, you know, I've worked with a lot of first-time directors, or at least a few. But oftentimes as well, like, I'm going to work with a filmmaker called Kogan Adda now in New York over here in May and June. And I saw a film that he did called Columbus. And I was, did you see it?
I didn't see
it. Really lovely, intimate film with John Cho.
I did see that one. Yeah.
So I'm going to work with him next. And I just saw that film and I just thought it was so beautifully told, and his framing was kind of, if Yorgos was a little more, a little less abstract and was doing a little more kind of, I don't want to say, a little more straight down the line drama, it'd kind of be what Kogan Adda did on this film. There's an awkwardness of framing, but it's very beautiful. It pulls you into the film, and there was a lack of histrionics, and the characters were dealing with very weighty themes, but they were just deeply and simply inside the story. So I'll go to work with him, you know. So I don't feel like I have any more acute a barometer than I ever did. But
is there a filmmaker that you've chased, whether consciously or unconsciously, over the years that you're surprised you haven't worked with yet?
I mean, no, not at all. I'm surprised really with the directors I have worked with.
It's an amazing
kind of list. Yeah, it's amazing, you know. I mean, there are filmmakers I really adore, and you know, it's like, I don't think there's a better filmmaker in the world than P.T. Anderson, you know. I just think he's just extraordinary. Do you see Phantom Thread?
Yeah.
I mean, the first 10 minutes of that, I was just lying on the couch, like catnip. It was like cinematic catnip.
Yeah, the second time I saw it, I was like, oh, wait, this is one of the best black comedies I've seen in, like, a decade.
That's pretty. This relationship between him and his sister is pretty special.
So great.
Yeah, it's
I will let you go. You probably have another plane to jump onto. Who knows where you're off to next?
Heading home, baby.
But good for you. But sounds like you'll spend some quality time in New York soon.
Yeah,
shooting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Excellent. Shot here.
Excellent. Congratulations. Thanks, on being Josh. Part of the crazy Tim Burton universe. Dumbo's a special one. Thanks. Everybody, check it out. We need a little light in the universe right now.
Yeah, for sure.
And thanks so much for your time today,
buddy.
Thanks,
Josh. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, man.
Cheers, pal.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.